This is Climate Justice, Y'all, a podcast dedicated to lifting up and centering the climate and environmental justice movement in the South. Despite the South being the most biodiverse, diverse, and one of the largest economic engines in the world, we are underfunded and often barred from the decision-making table. Because of that, we decide to pull up a chair and amplify the stories of communities in the South hit the hardest by the climate crisis.
We're using good old-fashioned storytelling to shine a spotlight on these Southern leaders from all walks of life, putting in their blood, sweat, and tears to transform the region. The usage of y'all in the title is on purpose. We are honoring our Southern heritage of creativity, resilience, and ingenuity.
All right, y'all, it is season two of Climate Justice, Y'all. Let's get started. Hey, y'all, I'm your host, Abigail Franks, and I am joined by the fabulous Marisha Malcolm. We all know that the rural South isn't exactly known for having the best infrastructure like roads, energy efficiency, internet access, water systems, et cetera, et cetera. The South, especially the Appalachian region, is no stranger to the effects of the fossil fuel industry and energy burden or accessibility.
Today, we're talking to someone from an organization that specifically works to help anyone from nonprofits to everyday citizens of Kentucky dealing with energy burdens and the lack of access to clean energy. Climate justice, y'all, it's real, it's here, and it's about time we listen to folks like Chris Woolery. All right, let's get started with the show.
All right, well, good afternoon, Mr. Chris Woolery. How are you? How's it going?
I'm doing pretty well. The sun's out today, and I'm hanging out with you guys. It's great to be with you.
Perfect, perfect. All right, well, how about we get started with you introducing yourself and the organization that you work for?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Chris Woolery. I live in Lexington, Kentucky. I use he, him pronouns, and I work for the Mountain Association, and we're a community development financial institution, basically a bank, a nonprofit bank with a mission that serves Appalachian counties in eastern Kentucky.
That's amazing.
Cool. So you do a lot of work in rural electric co-ops, correct?
Yeah, you know, even though we're a community development financial institution, we recognize that policy and storytelling and business support are all just as important as lending. And energy is one of the business support services that we offer to both clients, lending clients and others across the region. And we focus on energy policy because it's so critical to our clients, the people that we serve in Eastern Kentucky. Yeah, I'm sorry. To get back to your question, it does include working with rural electric cooperatives, both on the programmatic side, working with them to administer different energy efficiency programs, and on the policy side, you know, engaging with them around their policy and their sustainability and their integrated resource planning.
Okay, so can you go a little bit more in depth into like what electric co-ops are for those who don't know what it is and like why it's important?
Yeah, because I don't know about for most listeners, but I didn't know what electric co-ops were or if they even existed until I moved to Birmingham and started like hearing people talk about it. So what are rural electric co-ops?
Right.
Sure, thanks for asking. Well, imagine that, well, let me just say that when I first moved out of Lexington to the countryside in Kentucky, I was a member owner of a rural electric co-op, but I didn't know what that meant, and I didn't know what that was. And so I had gone from being a rate payer for an investor-owned utility called Kentucky Utilities, and moved, and it went into a different electric service territory that was served by Bluegrass Energy. Bluegrass Energy is actually owned by the members, the households, and the businesses that it serves, right? So that is a really cool thing. It goes way back. It was created, we created electric cooperatives to electrify the countryside when investors decided that it wasn't worth their investment. They weren't looking, they didn't see a return on the investment. And so folks came together and did it for themselves and for their own communities. But they couldn't do it without substantial investments and technical support from the federal government. And that's how we have the Rural Utility Service today. And so right now, the interesting thing about co-ops is we own them. We can control them, but we also have some issues that go all the way back to the founding of electric co-ops with debt, legacy debt for outdated infrastructure that really needs to be retired, that we owe to the federal government and to other lenders. As cooperative member owners, right? I get the benefits of owning my utility, but I'm also, we also have to pay for the debts that created that utility. So let me just go into a little bit of more about what makes a rural electric co-op different. It serves, you know, a huge swath of the country, maybe half of the land mass and 40% of the people. But that includes 90% of the persistent poverty counties in the country. So that's interesting. The way that they're structured means they are designed to serve their community instead of the interests of investors or capital. But when it comes to clean energy and just transition, those investments are lagging. And there's good reasons for that. Like I said, we already have big debts for outdated infrastructure. So policy change is needed.
So wait, am I understanding correctly? You said that we as ratepayers have to pay the debt of like building the infrastructure, like the electric infrastructure that we've been using for a while. And we're also having to figure out how to pay for like a just transition as well.
That's right. I'm sure.
Oh, you... man.
No big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. Okay. Well, goodness. So like, all right. And the thing is, like, you touched on a point earlier talking about how, like, you went from being a ratepayer to working with, like, rural electric co-ops. So I'm sure that was really interesting for you to kind of see both sides of what's going on behind closed doors and everything. A part of me wonders how democratic rural electric co-ops really are, because, like, you said that we have control as ratepayers, but honestly, like, I don't see that at all. What do you think about that?
Well, it's about practice, and just like democracy, it can wither if we don't participate, and it can be captured by special interests, just like any democracy. But the difference is, I'm sure like you were thinking when you signed up for your first energy electricity account, you weren't thinking, how much am I going to pay for the power plants that they build?
Yeah, not at all. They don't advertise that at all.
No, and really, if you signed up with an IOU, you know, the investors are on the hook for those payments, right? For the debts of the investor-owned utility. But the public service commissions, the regulators that decide, you know, what those utilities can do, almost guarantee the return on those investments. And so the difference is that since I'm a ratepayer at Kentucky Utilities, and I'm also going to be a member owner again soon, in a rural electric co-op. The difference there is I do get to help decide, if I so choose, what my debts in the future will be, right? The debts that we commit to as a community, as a cooperative, I can impact those decisions if I choose, right? And so it's about getting together, talking to folks, and there are people and communities across the country that have come together and made big changes at their cooperatives. And there are examples of those stories that are in Kentucky and across the Southeast and across the country.
Okay, so it sounds like there is a very intricate balance between like the ratepayers for this electric co-op, those who are working at the electric co-op, and also the Public Service Commission and the utilities when it comes to how we get our electricity and how it's dispersed. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah, because we don't have a marketplace, a quote unquote free market for electricity. I can't choose a different provider.
Yeah.
I might not even be able to choose, right, rooftop solar and get the same benefits that someone in another state might get. And so those decisions and those benefits and those agreements really come down to the regulators And those regulators are often called a public service commission or a public utility commission, and they may be elected or appointed depending on the state that you're in. And so it's just critical that the public is engaged with the regulatory agencies and the legislatures that enable and appoint them in certain cases, right? Or else then the utilities who have outsized power and budgets will really get to call the shots when it comes to our energy future. And that's really been something that's not been beneficial to us over the past and even in the present.
Yeah, it shows how important the Public Service Commission really is. And what's really interesting is that part one of this episode, we actually interview a public service commissioner to discuss like basically what his job is and everything that he does, Commissioner Brent Bailey from Mississippi. And so this is bringing a flip side to it, talking about the importance of that role, but also the importance of customers and ratepayers, like, I guess, showing what they want, if you will, like, you know, like a diversification of energy, for example. But some people, it's just almost like too much to even think about because they're even struggling to pay their own energy bills, which kind of leads directly into our next question.
So energy burden and energy access, as we all know, is a huge issue in rural southern communities. It's very limited, if you will. Can you talk about the energy burden in Kentucky and what can be done to address it?
Sure. If you were to look at a map of energy burden across the country, you would see concentrations of energy burdens in downtown cities, across Appalachia, in parts of the West, across the southern border. And those energy burdens, what an energy burden is how much of your income do you pay as a percentage towards energy? So it's affected by both the energy bills, the energy rates, the housing stock, and the job market. And so it's a really good indicator for how if people are struggling and how much they might be struggling. So for instance, you know, a 5% energy burden is considered high, but some people in Eastern Kentucky could be paying as high as 20%.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And so let's not just focus on Kentucky, right? Because rural households across the country face a higher energy burden, about a third higher than the nation as an average, about 42% higher than cities on average. And so rural communities, they need tools. They need inclusive utility investments. They need access to rooftop solar to lower their energy burdens and at the same time, right, get to the other side of the equation by creating good, well-paying jobs. And so, but if you're facing a 20% energy burden, what that means is devastatingly difficult impacts and choices that you have to make. Can you have to choose between medicine and your energy bill, or food in your energy bill, or even finally rent? Some folks might get behind on their energy bill and that could cause them to get evicted. And so all of these issues are interconnected and intersectional, but energy burden is a really good indicator, one of the indicators of quality of life.
So do you all provide tools to kind of help with like the energy burdens that are, let's just say, Kentucky specifically?
Yeah, like at Mountain Association in general. Since y'all are kind of on the side of ratepayers and everything, do y'all help address energy burden or anything? And if not, what do you think can be done to address it?
100%.
Sure, that's a great question. And it's not surprising that rural communities have led when it comes to solutions to energy burden. In fact, it's been rural communities and rural electric co-ops that have led the nation to understanding the idea of inclusive utility investments or programs like Pay As You Save, in which utilities can make investments not just in power lines and generation, but they can make investments in your home and your business, investments that don't just benefit you at home, but benefit the entire community and everyone that's paying for electricity. Now, that sounds too good to be true, but in fact, that's part of what we do at Mountain Association. We administer a program that's based on the pay-as-you-save model called House Smart Kentucky. And we've demonstrated through hundreds of investments and millions of dollars invested that you can invest in a home, reduce the energy bill, pay for the investment out of the savings, but still give a net cash flow to the rate to the participant. So the person that participates in House Smart Kentucky will get a more affordable, more healthy, durable, and comfortable home and save money at the same time while paying for the investment over time on the energy bill. Now, that doesn't just help that particular household, although the impact can be tremendous. In fact, I've been at the end of these jobs where the people are literally weeping because they couldn't have gotten a heat pump any other way. It doesn't just help that family. It can help lower the cost of the entire cooperative. In fact, you can look just around the corner in Wachita, Arkansas, and see a program that deployed inclusive utility investments and distributed solar generation at scale, and then delivered a 4.5% rate decrease to the rest of the cooperative.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it sounds like there's actual, like, as big as these problems are, at least it's encouraging that it seems like rural communities are, like, coming forth with the solutions that we need.
Right, grant solutions to help. So I know you kind of went into it, but can you go a little bit more into, like, what exactly a just transition, a just energy transition looks like in Appalachia?
Yeah, because Appalachia, like, it's kind of like ground zero for what happens when energy and labor policies don't take care of people first. Mm-hmm. And so what would a just transition, especially with energy, look like in Appalachia, and what steps need to be taken?
Well, thanks for asking. that's a pretty big question. I'll do my best to get at it.
Yeah, we believe it. Sorry. We're asking these questions because we know that you can answer them. You know, like, I don't think Mr. Chris gives himself enough credit for his expertise.
Well, thanks for that, and I'll do my best. I think you can't talk about a just transition without talking about what is and what was, right? We want to know about what can and should be. We have to start talking about what was. And what was in Eastern Kentucky, what happened was that folks came in to Eastern Kentucky and they found resources, namely coal, and they set about removing those resources. And Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia and other regions across the country, not just us, we helped fuel the Industrial Revolution. We helped get us through a couple of terrible world wars and provide all the energy that was needed to get that done. But guess what? Our communities still suffered. As a general rule, the industry wasn't benefiting the communities across the board. Not just resources were extracted, but wealth and labor were extracted from the regions. And I've heard this called, quote unquote, a resource curse. And you see it happen across the world and across history.
Exactly.
That have resources in your area. They may not benefit you. They're not actually likely to benefit you. They're actually likely to benefit others. And so here we are, right? In a, we got to a point where we were relying too much on a single industry, a mono economy that wasn't really benefiting the communities as a whole, was going through boom and bust cycles, but they also had a lot of political power. And so they were able to establish that as a status quo. And so over time, what that meant for Kentucky was, hey, we had coal, and so we had low electricity rates. In fact, many people didn't insulate their homes because they would bring home coal from work and burn it at home. The fuel might be free to folks in those coal communities. But low electricity rates don't necessarily mean you have low electricity bills if you don't have good housing stock, insulation, air sealing, and good equipment.
Yeah, it's like that in Alabama, that's for sure.
That's why we have these high energy burdens across the region. And so What do we need when we think about poor housing stock, barriers to access for weatherization and energy efficiency? Even if you qualified for weatherization, your home might not qualify for the investment. What we need is a new way of thinking and investments that don't just benefit the investors, but that benefit the community at large and that don't harm others. Those type of investments look like energy efficiency investments through pay-as-you-save programs or investments in distributed renewables on our homes and businesses that are actually owned, right, by the community. And that's what all the investments in a rural electric co-op are. They're owned by the community. We need resilience. We need microgrids that can be islands or be connected to the grid at whole, as a whole. We need local control of resources. So we don't need our co-ops to invest, right, in utility scale solar or wind two states away when they could be investing in our homes and businesses and making impacts right where we live and work. So finally, that's how we bring that transition and its benefits home, literally. Tangible improvements in our homes and businesses, healthier environments, buildings that are more durable and affordable, jobs that pay well, that help your neighbor and can never be outsourced, and finally, cleaner air and water, which is life.
Yeah, I mean, it's like what you were saying earlier. All of it is so intersecting and connecting. Like, once you deal with one issue, you can kind of deal with several. Like, the same reason why a lot of the problems that we face are all interconnected, I suppose all the solutions are too. So, yeah. Well, that kind of leads. So, with all of these issues that, you know, we're facing in Appalachia when it comes to energy burden or even energy access or weatherization or anything, what gives you hope amidst all these challenges and what keeps you going? Because you've been in this work for years now. And so what keeps you going?
You.
Oh.
It's people like you.
Oh.
Colleagues, friends, colleagues, coworkers, community members that are already building the solutions we need, that are already learning, or in many cases, relearning, right? Mm-hmm. Changes in the paradigm shifts and the changes in thinking that we so desperately need. And so, it's working with folks at the Indigenous Environmental Network and the mm-hmm. Justice Alliance, and of course, the Southeast Climate and Energy Network, that seeing the amazing work that is happening right down the road in Benham, Kentucky, in the heart of coal country, that's what gives me hope.